Disc 10.
At 52, Rear Admiral Sir Christopher Craddock was a small, immaculately dressed bachelor with wide-set eyes and a neatly trimmed, pointed beard. A diplomat's wife in Mexico described him as shining with that special, well-groomed English look. He lived alone except for his dog, who accompanied him everywhere, but he thrived on human society. Often on board Good Hope, he left his admiral's quarters and joined the ship's officers for a drink in the wardroom. An aide to the governor of the Falklands remembered that while Craddock was at Port Stanley, he and his dog would come wandering up to Government House every day for a yarn and a meal, or else the governor would go off to Good Hope. He was a dear old bloke and keen as a terrier. Kit Craddock had joined the Navy at 13, and had served afloat and ashore for 40 years. In 1900, as an officer in the China Squadron, Craddock was playing polo in Hong Kong with his friends Beatty and Keyes when the Boxer Rebellion broke out. He went ashore with a British naval brigade to capture the Taku forts, and, under heavy fire, led a company of British, German, and Japanese sailors across a sun-baked mud flat to storm the west gate of a fort. For this, the Kaiser gave him the Prussian Order of the Crown, with swords. In 1910, Fisher, as First Sea Lord, announced that Captain Craddock is one of our very best officers. He was promoted to Rear Admiral and knighted, and in February 1913 took command of the prestigious North American and West Indies station. The Navy was Craddock's life. The majesty and invincibility of the Royal Navy formed the bedrock of empire and the cornerstone of his beliefs. For him, said the contemporary naval writer Sir Archibald Hurd, the Navy was not a mere collection of ships, but a community of men with high purpose. In this brotherhood, tradition, courage, honour, and discipline counted more than ships, boiler power, and gun calibres. In his leisure, Craddock wrote 3 books about the Navy, including Whispers from the Fleet, a volume of avuncular advice for young officers. Among topics considered, Craddock counselled on burials at sea. When a hammock is being used as a shroud, the last stitch of the sailmaker's needle is neatly popped through the tip of the nose. Then there can be no mistake. Craddock was known in the fleet as a man who fought hard, played hard, and did not suffer fools gladly. His favourite signal was said to be, "Engage the enemy more closely." Home from the sea in his native Yorkshire, he hunted with near recklessness, and he told a friend and fellow admiral that he hoped, when his time came, it would be in action at sea, or by breaking his neck on the hunting field. By 1914, when he went to war, Craddock was one of the Royal Navy's most decorated admirals. Among the 3 rows of ribbons on the left breast of his jacket, however, 1 was stained with ink. "That ribbon," he told the governor's aide at Port Stanley, "belongs to the first-class Order of the Blue Ape, or something, that the Kaiser gave me. I couldn't tear it out without ruining all the others, so I got an ink bottle and made it look as unpleasant as possible." According to Luce, Craddock knew when he left Port Stanley that he was going to his doom. Sir William Allardyce, the governor of the Falklands, later told Luce that Craddock thought his chances were small, and that he had been let down by the Admiralty, especially when his request for defence had been denied. Bidding Allardyce farewell, Craddock said that he would never see him again, and gave Allardyce a large sealed packet to be sent home to the Admiralty as soon as his death was confirmed. The packet contained a letter to his friend Admiral Hedworth Merkes, to be forwarded only in case my squadron disappears, and me too, completely. I have no intention, after 40 years at sea, of being an unheard victim. To Merkes he vowed, "I will take care I do not suffer the fate of poor Trowbridge." The governor's aide at the Falklands had a similar recollection of Craddock's mood. The admiral was a very brave old man. He knew that he was going to almost certain death in fighting these new and powerful ships, and it seemed to be quite all right as far as he was concerned. He knew what he was up against, and asked for a fast cruiser with big guns to be added to his squadron, for he had nothing very powerful and nothing very fast. But the Admiralty said he'd have to go without. So old Craddock said, "All right, we'll do without," and he slipped off quietly early one morning, and left Canopus to look after the colliers and transports, and picked up Glasgow and Monmouth, and set off to look for these crack Germans. On October 26th, as Good Hope was steaming north up the coast of Chile, Craddock signalled his intentions to the Admiralty. He confirmed his determination to find and to fight Spee, but he also made clear his distaste for Canopus and his desire for defence. With reference to orders to search for the enemy and our great desire for early success, I consider it impractical on account of Canopus's slow speed to find and destroy enemy squadron. Have therefore ordered defence to join me after calling for orders at Montevideo. Canopus will be employed in necessary work of convoying colliers. This message arrived on October 27th, at a time of turmoil at the Admiralty. Battenberg was about to resign, and on October 30th Churchill recalled Fisher. Thus it was that on the days when Glasgow was off Coronel, Good Hope, Monmouth, and Otranto were steaming north to join her, and Canopus was labouring up from the Magellan Straits, Churchill was, in his own words, gravely preoccupied. He passed Craddock's signal to the war staff with the minute, "This telegram is very obscure, and I do not understand what Craddock intends or wishes." In fact, Craddock's message angered the First Lord. The Admiral appeared either to have obtusely misunderstood or to be deliberately thwarting Admiralty orders. Craddock was saying that Canopus, the citadel around which he had been told to concentrate his squadron, was useless to him, and that he was relegating this citadel to convoy work. Further, Craddock was telling Stoddart to send him Defence, the ship around which the new East Coast squadron was to be built. Indeed, Stoddart immediately protested that if Defence was taken from him, he must immediately be sent two additional fast cruisers to replace her. On the evening of October 28th, Churchill abruptly countermanded Craddock's orders to Stoddart to send him Defence. "Defence is to remain on East Coast under orders of Stoddart," decreed the Admiralty. "This will leave sufficient force on each side in case the hostile cruisers appear there on the trade route." Regarding Craddock's decision to relegate Canopus to convoy work, the Admiralty made no comment. The words "sufficient force" emphasized that the Admiralty did not consider that Craddock required any addition to his squadron in order to fulfil his mission. But had Defence been present at Coronel, the outcome might have been different. Her guns matched those of Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, and her presence would have given Craddock a second regular Royal Navy ship and a second fully trained Royal Navy crew. It still would have been two professionally manned British ships against five Germans, but with Good Hope and Monmouth adding their guns, the scale might have been balanced. This was Craddock's view. In the end, Defence was an unlucky ship. As Trowbridge's flagship in the Mediterranean, she had played an unheroic role in the Goeben fiasco. Now, as Craddock went to meet Spee, Defence remained idle at the River Plate. 18 months later, she blew up and sank at Jutland. The Admiralty's message probably reached the Admiral around 1 p.m. on November 1st, when Glasgow brought it out to the flagship from Coronel. If he read it, the signal would explain his subsequent behaviour. His decision to leave Canopus behind apparently had been approved, for the Admiralty had made no comment. Defence had again been denied him, and he had been assured that, without these two ships, his squadron still constituted a sufficient force. Thus, five ships, of which only one, the smallest, was ready to fight a modern, well-trained foe, represented the Royal Navy off the west coast of South America on November 1st, 1914. The words "sufficient force" must have seared the soul of a fearless and experienced officer whose impetuous character was well known at the Admiralty, Hurst wrote later. Churchill was to argue that the "sufficient force" signal never reached Craddock, who was therefore not influenced by it in reaching his bold and suicidal decision. But Hurst said it reached Glasgow during her visit to Coronel, that his ship brought it out to Good Hope just before the action, and that he was certain that Craddock read it. Thereafter, tired of protesting his inferiority, the receipt of this telegram would be sufficient to spur Craddock to hoist, as he did half an hour later, his signal, "Spread 15 miles apart and look for the enemy." 3 hours later he met the East Asia squadron. Craddock's last signal, wireless to Canopus, was a proper epitaph for a man who had always hoped he would break his neck on the hunting field or be killed in battle. "I am going to attack the enemy now." Churchill later admitted that had he not been distracted by the Admiralty upheaval over Battenberg's departure and Fisher's arrival, "I am sure I should have reacted much more violently to the ominous sentence, 'Shall employ Canopus convoying colliers.' October 30th, was Fisher's first day back in office as First Sea Lord, and Churchill gave the old admiral a 2-hour briefing on the worldwide deployment of the Royal Navy.
"The critical point," Churchill recalled, "was in South American waters. Speaking of Admiral Craddock's position, I said, 'You don't suppose he would try to fight them without the Canopus?' He did not give any decided reply."
On the morning of October 27th, Good Hope joined Glasgow, Monmouth, and Otranto in the remote fjord of Valinor Roads, where Craddock was beyond wireless contact with the Admiralty. Still hoping to receive further clarification or modification of his orders by way of Montevideo, he dispatched Glasgow back to Coronel to collect any waiting messages that might have come over land wire. Before Glasgow left, she sent a boat around the anchorage to collect outgoing mail from the other ships. Visiting in the wardrooms of the armoured cruisers, Hurst found most officers expecting a battle and fatalistic about their prospects. "Two of the lieutenant commanders in Monmouth, both old shipmates, took me aside to give me farewell messages to their wives," he said. "Glasgow has got the speed," they told him, "so she can get away, but we are for it." When the light cruiser departed at 6:30 p.m., she carried Craddock's last signal to the Admiralty. "Monmouth, Good Hope, and Otranto coaling at Valinor. Glasgow patrolling vicinity of Coronel to intercept German shipping. Joining flag later on. I intend to proceed northward secretly with squadron after coaling and keep out of sight of land." Canopus, then ploughing through the Straits of Magellan, was not mentioned. 2 days later, as Craddock and his squadron were leaving Valinor, Canopus and her 2 colliers appeared in the fjord. The old battleship, her captain reported, could go no further without spending another 24 hours repairing her high-pressure piston glands. Craddock told Captain Grant to anchor, do the work, and follow as soon as possible. Grant, however, never reported to Craddock that his ship's potential speed now was higher than 12 knots. Later he explained that, knowing the Admiral's opinion of his ship, he doubted the squadron would wait for him to catch up. Whether Craddock, knowing the truth about Canopus's marginally higher speed, would have waited and fought the battle in her company will never be known. Meanwhile, Glasgow was steaming north. "Alone this time, much to my satisfaction," said Luce. On the afternoon of the 29th, the wireless office began to intercept heavy traffic in German code, indicating that a warship, the signals indicated Leipzig, was not far away. "The signals were so strong," Luce said, "that we expected to sight the enemy at any moment." As a result, Luce hesitated to take his ship into Coronel. He worried that if he entered the neutral port, he might be trapped in a place where his ship's greater speed would be useless. He signalled Craddock, who gave permission to delay entering the harbour. Accordingly, for 2 days, Glasgow waited outside Coronel. On the night of the 30th, Luce again heard Leipzig's call sign broadcast from no more than 150 miles away. But at daybreak, the ocean was empty. At twilight on October 31st, Glasgow entered Coronel Harbour, and Hurst, the intelligence officer, went ashore to collect and send messages and mail. In handing over papers, the worried British consul stressed to Hurst the existence of a strongly German and pro-German minority along the Chilean coast, and the consequent probability that the light cruiser's presence already had been reported. That night, in full view of the anchored Glasgow, the German consulate and the German merchant ships in the harbour blazed with light. One of these vessels was Göttingen, a supply ship that Spee had sent into Coronel and that promptly signalled her admiral, "British light cruiser anchored in Coronel Roads at 7 p.m. on 31st October." At 2 a.m., Glasgow's wireless room was listening to almost continuous, high-singing telefunken signal notes that indicated the presence of enemy ships in the vicinity. The number of wireless messages convinced Luce that the German squadron was approaching, and he decided to sail at 9 o'clock the next morning. Craddock, sweeping up from the south and hoping to catch Leipzig, ordered Luce to rendezvous with the squadron 40 miles west of Coronel at noon the next day, November 1st. Admiral von Spee, leaving Massafuera on October 27th, had been informed by a German port agent at Punta Arenas that a British Queen-class battleship had been seen that day headed west through the Straits of Magellan. In fact, the ship was Canopus. It was an understandable mistake. The two classes had similar profiles and similar armament, but the Queen's were 5 years younger, and the 2,000 extra tons they carried had gone into armour and engines. He also knew from other German agents that ships of Admiral Craddock's squadron had appeared farther up the Chilean coast. Accordingly, soon after his men saw the peaks of the Andes, he ordered his two armoured cruisers to remain out of sight of the coast, and instructed that all wireless communications between warships be preceded by Leipzig's call sign. Spee realized that the presence of this light cruiser was known, and he hoped that this duplicity would keep the presence of his other ships a secret. On October 30th, he began sending his supply ships into Valparaiso and Coronel to take on supplies and coal. On the 31st, the Admiral himself was at sea in Scharnhorst, 50 miles off Valparaiso, when he learned from Göttingen that Glasgow had slipped into Coronel. As the British ship could not remain in port more than 24 hours without violating Chilean neutrality, Spee decided to trap and destroy this relatively small enemy. If Glasgow used all of her 24 hours, she would sail by the end of the afternoon on November 1st. Accordingly, Spee planned to arrive off Coronel before 5 p.m. Nürnberg was assigned to steam past the harbour entrance to see whether the British cruiser was there. The remaining ships were to spread in an arc outside, with Scharnhorst to the north and Gneisenau to the south. Both admirals thus suffered from the same misunderstanding. Each believed himself to be pursuing a single enemy light cruiser, and neither was aware of the presence of other, larger enemy ships. Sunday, November 1st, was All Saints' Day, and Spee's seamen, coming down from Valparaiso toward Coronel, rejoiced in a clear early spring morning. The sea was dark green, and the strong wind from the south tipped the crests of the waves with white foam which sparkled in the sunlight. At 10:30 a.m., the crew of Gneisenau went to church service on deck, but the hymn, "Ein feste Burg ist unser Gott," "A mighty fortress is our God," was muffled by the sound of the wind howling in the rigging and sending bursts of spray back from the foredeck. The midday meal included special allowances of cocoa and bread spread with marmalade. By noon, the wind, moving around to the southwest, had reached force 7, 28 to 33 knots, or 31 to 37 miles per hour, and the ships, plunging south at 14 knots through the heavy swell, began to pitch and roll. The squadron was strung out. Scharnhorst, Gneisenau, and Leipzig were in front, and the other two light cruisers behind. Toward noon, when Nürnberg stopped to examine two Chilean ships, she fell back 25 miles astern of the flagship. At 4 p.m., when British wireless signals became very loud, Nürnberg was ordered to rejoin. At 4:17, Leipzig sighted smoke and masts across the stormy seas far to starboard, and at 4:20 a drum thundered the order, "Clear the decks for action." Coming closer, the Germans could see the funnels and then the hulls of the British light cruiser Glasgow and the armed merchant cruiser Otranto. The morning of November 1st dawned bright on board Glasgow in Coronel Harbour. Patches of fog lingering on the hilltops around the bay blew away in a strong wind that tempered the warmth of a spring day. At 9:15 a.m., having collected messages and mail for the Admiral and the squadron, Glasgow carefully slipped out of the harbour. Out in the open sea, Luce saw nothing. He took his ship north until he was out of sight of land, then turned southwest. As the light cruiser's bow plunged into the rising sea, green water swept the foredeck and spray whipped over the bridge. 4 hours later, 40 miles west of Coronel Bay, Luce sighted Good Hope, Monmouth, and Otranto coming north at 15 knots. The flagship and Monmouth were already rolling like barrels, and Otranto, with the sail area of her tall side broadside to the wind, was even worse. At the rendezvous point, the strong wind and heavy sea made it impossible for any ship to lower a boat. In order to transfer to Craddock the messages and intelligence he had brought out from Coronel, Luce placed the papers in a 6-inch cartridge case, which Glasgow towed slowly across the bows of the flagship which had come to a halt. Using a grapnel, Good Hope's crew plucked the case from the sea, an effort that earned both ships Craddock's signal A manoeuvre well executed. Meanwhile, strong wireless signals indicated that Leipzig was not far to the north. Having heard nothing from the German armoured cruisers, Craddock assumed that they were not nearby. At 1:50 p.m., the Admiral signalled his squadron to form a line of search, spreading fanwise east to west, 15 miles between ships, heading north at 10 knots. Nearest the coast was Glasgow, with her professional regular Navy crew. Next to her was Monmouth, with a reserve crew and 12 young naval cadets. Beyond, the thin-skinned Otranto, looming like a haystack out of the sea, and farther west, carrying the only two heavy guns in the British squadron, Good Hope. On board the flagship, as his squadron swept north over the tumultuous seas, Craddock went to his cabin to study his messages and go through his mail. Chapter 12. The Battle of Coronel. Leipzig was not alone off Coronel that afternoon. Vice-Admiral Count Maximilian von Spee was there with the whole strength of the German East Asia Squadron. Once Glasgow was sighted to the southwest, Spee moved to intercept her. He ordered all boilers lighted, summoned his two lagging light cruisers Dresden and Nuremberg, and without waiting for them began to chase. Black smoke belched from Scharnhorst's funnels. "In a quarter of an hour," Spee wrote later, "we were steaming at 20 knots against a heavy sea, throwing up clouds of spray which soaked to the bones the men in the forward turret and the magazine below." Meanwhile, Leipzig had also seen Monmouth and Otranto, and had informed the admiral. The chase phase of the action continued for 90 minutes. Once the British had reversed direction, the two squadrons were steaming south on almost parallel courses, separated by 15,000 yards. Spee, aware that he had the superior force, made his preparations calmly. "Does my smoke disturb you?" he signalled to Gneisenau, and made adjustments to Scharnhorst's course to give her sister a clear view of the targets. When the sun was sufficiently low on the horizon, not to dazzle the gunners, and the enemy ships were sharply outlined against the blaze of the setting sun, while the lofty Chilean coast, dark and cloud-capped, formed our background, we—the writer was an officer on Gneisenau— on signal from Scharnhorst, moved towards the enemy. The distance, then about 13,500 yards, began to diminish more rapidly. The eyes of the range-finders were glued to the rubber eyelets of their long-range field-glasses, through which they perceived the enemy magnified 10 times. Spee opened fire at 7:04 p.m. at 11,000 yards. Each German ship was instructed to fire at the corresponding ship in the enemy line. Scharnhorst at Good Hope, Gneisenau at Monmouth, Leipzig at Glasgow, and Dresden at Otranto. After the first salvo, Scharnhorst fired 3 salvos a minute, and at 7:09 observed her first hit on Good Hope. Soon afterward, Craddock's ships began to fire back. The sun was sinking in the western sky at 4:20 p.m. when Luce, heading north, saw smoke on his starboard bow toward the coast. Otranto, then only 2 miles west of Glasgow, signalled that she too had seen the smoke on the horizon. Luce reported this to Craddock, 50 miles away in Good Hope, then rang for full speed and turned to investigate. The smoke cloud expanded as he approached. Soon, from a distance of 12 miles, 24,000 yards, he identified a 3-funnelled light cruiser, and then, farther off, 2 4-funnelled armoured cruisers. Luce knew instantly what they were. "We had in sight the 2 German armoured cruisers. Until that moment, Scharnhorst and Gneisenau were not positively known to be on the Chilean coast. "But when we saw those damned 4 funnels," said another Glasgow officer, "we knew there was the devil to pay." Luce steamed closer to establish Spee's course. "Enemy steering between southeast and south," he signalled, and then turned away to gather up Monmouth and Otranto and join Good Hope, still out of sight to the west. Craddock, who had learned of Leipzig's presence about the same time that Spee was informed of Glasgow's, immediately turned toward the enemy. For a few minutes, when the 2 squadrons first made contact, both admirals were surprised, each believing that he had been closing in on a solitary enemy light cruiser. This impression was sustained by the coincidence that Leipzig, the single German light cruiser that Craddock expected to find, was the first to be sighted by the British force, while Glasgow, the light cruiser that Spee had hoped to trap in Coronel, was the first to be seen by the German squadron. Before Craddock, steaming north, turned toward the enemy, he had the entire Pacific Ocean on his port bow, with ample sea room to escape. Good Hope, Monmouth, and Glasgow all could make more than 20 knots, and thus were faster than von Spee's two armoured cruisers. But Otranto's best speed that afternoon was 16 knots, inferior to all of the German ships. Thus, while Craddock, with his three warships, might have run for protection back to the 12-inch guns of Canopus, he could have done so only by leaving Otranto behind. Later, critics asked why Otranto was present at all with the British squadron at Coronel. The answer is that Craddock had not expected to meet the East Asia squadron that afternoon. He was hunting one light cruiser, and in this effort, Otranto, by extending his search line, had a useful part to play. Once Scharnhorst and Gneisenau appeared, however, Otranto became a heavy liability. If Craddock slowed down to her speed, he surrendered 6 or 7 knots. If he left her behind, she could fall prey to any one of the German ships. "We all thought he would leave Otranto," wrote Glasgow's gunnery officer, "but he did not like leaving her to look after herself. She is such an enormous hulk she can be seen for miles on the darkest night." Craddock made his choice, signalling his squadron, "I cannot go down and engage the enemy at present, leaving Otranto." Craddock now knew that the long-anticipated encounter with Spee was at hand. At 5:10 p.m. he signalled all ships to head toward Glasgow, the ship nearest the enemy. Having decided to fight, and because Royal Navy ships were not trained for battle at night, he decided to force an action while daylight remained. He formed his ships into a single line, Good Hope leading, then Monmouth, Glasgow, and Otranto, on a southeasterly course at 16 knots, the highest speed of which Otranto was capable. His intention was to bring the Germans within range of his squadron's numerous 6-inch guns. Unfortunately, this course also headed the ships diagonally across a heavy sea on the side toward the enemy. Here the waves rolling up against the closed casements of Good Hope's and Monmouth's port lower gun batteries rendered these guns useless. With these gun ports closed, and because of the shorter range of all of the British 6-inch guns, Spee's 16 8.2-inch guns were opposed at this stage only by the two 9.2-inch guns of Good Hope. Thereafter, for almost an hour, the two lines of ships swept south on a roughly parallel course 14,000 yards apart. To British sailors looking across the water, the German squadron gave an intimidating impression of confidence and power. Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, their red, gold, and black battle flags stiff in the wind, black smoke billowing from their funnels, the waves racing along their towering white sides, seemed to ride irresistibly over the seas. To the west, the British line represented a hodgepodge assembly, wallowing and plunging through the swells, green water breaking over their bows, their main deck guns awash, their telescopes and gun sights drenched by icy spray and encrusted with salt. Nevertheless, Craddock believed that he had a chance. His position to the west of Spee offered a great advantage in terms of light. The British squadron was between the enemy and the setting sun, putting the low afternoon rays directly into the Germans' eyes. As the British closed the range, the sun would blind the German gun layers, while at the same time lighting up the German ships as targets. Conversely, Craddock realized, after the sun went down, this advantage would be reversed. Rather than having the setting sun in their eyes, the enemy gunners would be looking, for at least half an hour after sunset, at the black shapes of his ships starkly silhouetted against the afterglow in the western sky. The Germans, meanwhile, would be lost in the grey obscurity of the inshore twilight. Craddock decided to force an immediate action. To have a chance, he knew that he must come close enough to effectively use his armoured cruiser's 17 6-inch guns. At 6:18 p.m. he increased speed to 17 knots, hoisted the signal, "Follow in the Admiral's wake," and turned closer toward the enemy. At the same moment, he wirelessed Canopus, labouring up the coast 250 miles to the south, "I am going to attack the enemy now." Admiral von Spee refused to have it so. He realized, as well as Craddock, the danger of having his gun layers blinded by glare from the setting sun, and he had no intention of letting his enemy come within range until the sun had set. His squadron speed now was 20 knots, giving him the power to dictate time and range, and he deliberately refused immediate action. Edging away to port, keeping himself between Craddock and the coast, he established a new range of 18,000 yards. Thwarted, Craddock turned back to a parallel southerly course. Then, as the sun slid into the sea and evening crept over the sky, the German ships became indistinct against the background of gathering darkness. To the west, the four British ships, steaming in a neat line one behind the other, were sharp-etched in black silhouette against the red-gold panorama of the afterglow. At 6:50 p.m., the sun sank beneath the horizon. "And now began the saddest naval action in the war," Winston Churchill wrote. "Of the officers and men in both the squadrons that faced each other in these stormy seas so far from home, 9 out of 10 were doomed to perish. The British were to die that night, the Germans a month later."
Once the advantage of light had abandoned Craddock, Spee immediately altered course and brought his ships to within 12,300 yards of the British squadron. At 7:04 p.m. he hoisted the signal to open fire, and orange flashes blossomed from Scharnhorst and Gneisenau. Soon grey-white mushrooms, beautifully grouped, rose from the sea 500 yards short of the British flagship. From the beginning, despite the fact that the ships on both sides were rolling, the shooting of the two German armoured cruisers was not merely superior, it was remarkable. It was as if they were at peacetime gunnery practice. Scharnhorst's first salvo landed 500 yards short of Good Hope. Her second was 500 yards over. Then, with an awful inevitability, the third salvo smashed into the British flagship. Within 5 minutes, Spee had achieved decisive hits on both British armoured cruisers. Scharnhorst's third salvo had struck Good Hope's forward 9.2-inch gun turret, and her foredeck exploded in flames. Thus, even before he fired his first shot, Craddock was deprived of one of his squadron's two big guns. Meanwhile, Gneisenau fired rapid salvos at Monmouth, striking her forecastle. As Good Hope and Monmouth steamed through a forest of waterspouts, men on Glasgow observed the curious effect of sheets of flame continuously bathing the sides of both ships, with the heavy sea sliding along the sides seeming to have no effect. Craddock decided to move in closer, and with every minute the tactical disadvantage of the British ships increased. The Germans now were almost invisible. Heavy seas pounding against their ships were sending bursts of spray into the faces of the British gunners. Telescopes were blurred, and in the growing darkness spotters could not mark the fall of shots. There was nothing at which to aim except the flashes of the German guns, while Spee's gun layers continued to hit their well-defined targets with salvos fired 3 a minute. The battle quickly became, in the words of one British survivor, "the most rotten show imaginable." Two relatively new German cruisers, winners of competitive gunnery tests in the German Navy, and manned by 2,200 trained German sailors, were pitted against two obsolete ships manned by scratch crews of Britons, the vast majority of whom had been happily pursuing civilian lives less than 6 months before. The lower deck guns of the German armoured cruisers were able to fire, but the main deck casements of Good Hope and Monmouth had to be kept closed, lest the guns be smothered by the sea. Not that the German ships faced no difficulties. "The waves rose high in the strong wind," said one German officer. "Water foamed up over the cruisers' forecastles, and then flowed streaming over the upper decks. The crews and ammunition carriers found it difficult to keep their feet." An English 6-inch shell penetrated on the starboard side into the officers' wardroom, where it burst. Water poured in rapidly, but the ship's carpenters, up to their necks in water, stopped the leak. A British shell hit the after turret between the guns and temporarily jammed the mechanism that enabled the turret to rotate. It was repaired, and the guns reopened fire. But for the British, it was infinitely worse. Glasgow never observed any gunfire at all from the lower gun casements of the two British armoured cruisers. That meant that 16 German 8.2-inch guns were opposed by only one 9.2-inch gun
and a few 6-inch guns. The German salvos thundered rhythmically at 20-second intervals, whereas, Spee reported, the British gunners fired only one salvo to his 3. Otranto played no active part in the battle. Dresden had fired briefly at the armed merchant cruiser, and Otranto's Captain Edwards, seeing that his ship could do nothing useful, signalled Craddock to ask if he should keep out of range. Craddock's reply was garbled and provided no clear orders. Then Gneisenau put 2 shells over Edwards' bridge, and a column of water spouted up 50 yards off his starboard bow. Unable to reply with his 4-inch guns, Edwards prudently drew out of line onto Glasgow's starboard quarter. Even here, owing to her huge bulk and the short range of her guns, Otranto could serve no purpose except as a looming target, which the enemy could use to determine the range to the British line. Realizing this, Captain Edwards took her away to the west as fast as she would go. The main action lasted only 52 minutes. With the early loss of Good Hope's forward 9.2-inch gun, Craddock's chances of harming the enemy at anything but 6-inch gun range had been cut in half. Even his smaller guns had little effect. Monmouth's 6-inch gunfire was at first very rapid, but because Gneisenau was out of range, the British shells landed in the sea. And once Gneisenau turned her full attention on Monmouth, the British shooting quickly became ragged. Her gun crews fought their guns, but the foredeck was burning and black smoke billowed along her exposed port side. Outranged by German guns which were straddling the British line along its length, and with his own 6-inch guns having difficulty reaching the enemy, Craddock had a single thought: to come still closer. As he led his squadron across the shell-torn seas to bring his 6-inch guns to bear, he was punished fiercely, and Good Hope's masthead and foretop repeatedly glowed red as shells from Scharnhorst burst against them. By 7:23 p.m., the range was down to 6,600 yards, and still Craddock came on. Spee, fearing that this was a torpedo attack, edged away to the east. At 7:35 p.m., Craddock still plunged toward the German line 5,500 yards away. The enemy had the range perfectly, and all their salvos straddled our lines. The scene was appalling, said a Glasgow officer. As the British kept coming, Gneisenau's guns shortened the range, and the execution became terrible. One shell struck Monmouth's 4-6-inch turret and blew off the roof. As flames licked up out of the steel shell, a second, larger explosion shattered the entire forward part of the ship. When the flames subsided, the forward turret had completely disappeared. Still, Gneisenau's shells crashed through her decks. Heavy seas were flooding into her gaping bows, and she began heeling to port. Then, as though beaten out of line by sheer weight of metal, Monmouth began to lose speed and yaw away to starboard. For a while it seemed to those watching from Glasgow that she was having some success in overcoming her fires, but she never rejoined the line, and gradually her guns lapsed into silence. Darkness settled. The moon came up behind the clouds, and the Germans, except for the relentless flashes of their guns, were invisible to their enemies. Not so Good Hope and Monmouth, which flared like twin beacons. Frequently both ships, already bright with flames, flashed into vivid orange as another shell detonated against their superstructures. In the dark, the German gun layers used the fires in the British ships as aiming points. "As the 2 big enemy ships were in flames," noted one German officer, "we were able to economize on our use of searchlights." Good Hope was in forlorn condition. Although the single 9.2-inch gun on her stern continued to fire once a minute, the shells crashing into her flagship had ripped away her upper works and decks, and the smoke pouring from her funnels was an incandescent red. Still, she pushed stubbornly ahead, her upper port 6-inch battery defiant. At 7:42 p.m., Good Hope, as though in a final desperate effort to sell her life dearly, gathered all her remaining strength, turned directly toward her tormentors, and charged them, trailing fiery clouds of flame behind her. Spee ordered his ships out of her path, and then, at a range of less than 5,000 yards, poured in rapid-fire broadsides from both Scharnhorst and Gneisenau. His salvos blanketed Good Hope. She staggered under the rain of blows, and came to a halt with her upper deck a sea of flame. It was now quite dark, with the moon intermittently obscured by clouds and occasional rain squalls. By 7:50 p.m., the stricken British flagship, which had absorbed at least 35 direct hits from Scharnhorst, could be seen silent and burning close to the enemy. A Glasgow midshipman, watching Good Hope, saw her funnels illuminated by a fire burning near the bridge. A moment later there was a tremendous detonation, and the whole of her forepart shot up in a fan-shaped sheet of flame. A broad column of flame rose from amidships, where it illuminated a cloud of debris flung still higher in the air. "She looked," said Spey, "like a splendid firework display against a dark sky. The glowing white flames, mingled with bright green stars, shot up to a great height." Then the column of fire broke and fell, to wash along the decks and cover the hull with waves of flame. Debris crashed into the sea, and the forward section of the ship silently detached itself and slid down into oblivion. Incredibly, 2 6-inch guns of the afterport battery each fired twice more into the darkness. Then her fire ceased, and she lay drifting, a low, dark, gutted hull, illuminated by a red glare. After this, all was black, and, despite her proximity, she was never seen again. Ironically, so close had Good Hope been to the German line that for a moment Glasgow's gunners thought it was the German flagship, not their own, that had exploded. In contrast to the horrors that descended on Good Hope and Monmouth, Glasgow bore a charmed existence. At 7:05, Glasgow had begun firing her 2 6-inch guns over 10,000 yards, first at Leipzig and then at Dresden. Glasgow's gun layers, firing from a rolling platform only 8 feet above the waterline, could hardly see their targets, and the smoke of Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, driven by the wind, made them even more difficult. Nevertheless, Glasgow continued firing while her gunnery officer searched in the darkness for signs of the fall of shot. The effort was fruitless, and Glasgow hit neither Leipzig nor Dresden. Meanwhile, the 2 German light cruisers were firing back. Leipzig's initial salvo fell short of Glasgow, and her fire remained ineffective until 7:15 p.m., when the British cruiser came within range of the German 4.1-inch guns. From that point on, Luce's ship was engaging both German light cruisers, and at times also Gneisenau. All this time, Glasgow could see the 2 bigger British ships being cruelly punished. No one on board Glasgow actually saw Good Hope founder, but everyone knew that she could not have survived. Once the British flagship was gone, Scharnhorst switched her fire to Monmouth, and Gneisenau to Glasgow. Huge splashes began erupting around the unarmoured British light cruiser. Moonlight gave Glasgow an occasional glimpse of the enemy ships, and, shifting fire from Leipzig to Gneisenau, she scored at least one hit with her forward 6-inch on Gneisenau's after turret. For a few minutes the turret could not be trained, but the armour was not pierced, and soon the German guns returned to action. By 8 o'clock, Luce knew that he was tempting fate by continuing the action. For an hour his ship had been exposed to the fire of both Leipzig and Dresden, and for 10 minutes he was the target of the 8.2-inch shells of Gneisenau. His own guns could do little against this adversary, and his gunnery officer was unable even to see the splashes of his shells in order to correct ranges. The moon was rising behind the enemy, dimly showing him up at times, while he could no longer see us, and they only fired when they could see the flash of our guns, Luce said. We kept up our fire a little longer, until I realized that each time we fired, we brought on ourselves the combined fire of the whole German squadron. Accordingly, at 8:05, Luce ordered his ship to cease fire. Luce's ship had been extraordinarily lucky. In part, this was due to the difficulties Dresden and Leipzig had faced in fighting their guns while pitching and rolling in the heavy seas. Together, the 2 German light cruisers had fired more than 600 shells at Glasgow, but had hit her only 5 times. 3 shells had lodged harmlessly in coal bunkers, where the lumps of coal had squelched their explosive force. 1 broke up, without bursting, against a conning tower support. The only significant hit came from a 4.1-inch shell from the Leipzig that burst aft on the waterline just above the port outer propeller and tore a large hole about 6 feet square. 1 compartment was flooded, but there was no spreading or damage to the adjacent compartments, and the ship's speed was not affected. Glasgow was still able to steam away at 24 knots and cover 5,000 miles before she was repaired. Remarkably, not a single man of Glasgow's crew was killed or severely wounded. 4 slightly wounded seamen returned to duty within a few days. Glasgow's parrots were not as lucky. As the ship went into action, it was decided that it would be unkind to leave the birds in their cages, and although the vessel was 50 miles from the coast, the parrots were released. For a while, each time the guns were fired, they rose, flew about, then settled back on Glasgow's upper deck. As the battle wore on, the parrots became dazed and perched apathetically about the ship. Hurst saw 2 perched on a gun barrel just before it fired. Others lined up on the funnel stays and the edges of boats. Only 10 parrots survived the battle. Once Luce ceased firing, he turned to see what he could do for the stricken Monmouth. At 8:15 p.m. he found the battered armoured cruiser listing and down by the bow. The fires on her deck had been put out, and she was trying to turn to the north to get her undamaged stern into the large waves rolling up from the south. By the time Glasgow arrived, the moon in the east had risen above the clouds to light up the sea and reveal 4 enemy ships approaching in line abreast. Soon they would sight the British ships. "Are you all right?" Luce signalled by flashing light. Monmouth's captain, Frank Brandt, replied, "I want to get stern to sea. I'm making water badly forward." "Can you steer northwest?" Luce asked, hoping that the Monmouth could limp to the Chilean coast. "The enemy are following us astern," he added. For almost 10 minutes, Glasgow hung off Monmouth's port quarter, but there was nothing Luce could do. The enemy was near, the area was flooded with moonlight, and Luce had to decide whether to share Monmouth's fate without being able to render any real assistance or to attempt to escape. "I felt that I could not help her, but must be destroyed with her if we remained," Luce said later. "With great reluctance I therefore turned to the northwest and increased to full speed." Before leaving, Glasgow passed under the Monmouth's stern. As the light cruiser went by for the last time, the crew of the stricken ship was heard cheering, and, amid the voices of men, some thought they heard the higher notes of a boy. 2 of Glasgow's officers later justified Luce's decision. "It was obvious that Monmouth could neither fight nor fly," said one. "It was essential that there should be a survivor of the action to turn Canopus, which was hurrying at her best speed, to join up, and, if surprised alone by 4 or 5 ships, must have shared the fate of the other ships." "Monmouth was therefore reluctantly left to her fate," another officer agreed. "It was awful having to leave," he said, "but I don't see what else the skipper could have done." Glasgow headed west at full speed, losing sight of Monmouth astern at 8:50 p.m., and then turned south toward Canopus. Throughout the action, the Germans had ceaselessly jammed British wireless transmissions, and Glasgow had been unable to get any messages through. Now, as she raced south, the jamming effect declined, and her wireless was able to tell Canopus the dreadful story. At first, as Glasgow rushed south at 24 knots, there was hope that Monmouth might have eluded the enemy and be limping to safety. Then, half an hour later, the men on Glasgow's decks saw a searchlight beam flickering on the northern horizon. Distant firing broke out again, and 75 gun flashes were counted. Then silence. Glasgow knew that the Germans had found Monmouth. Later, one Glasgow officer remembered that, "Utterly dispirited and sick at heart, I went down to my cabin to snatch a few hours of sleep. I threw myself onto my bunk, wet clothes and all. We were humiliated to the very depths of our beings. We hardly spoke to one another for the first 24 hours. We felt so bitterly ashamed of ourselves, for we had let down the King, we had let down the Admiralty, we had let down England. What would the British public think of the Royal Navy?" By 8:15 p.m., with the ocean shining under bright moonlight broken by clouds and scattered rain squalls, Admiral von Spee had lost contact with his enemies. Scharnhorst slowed, and with his flagship lying athwart the sea and rolling heavily, Spee signalled his light cruisers. "Both British armoured cruisers severely damaged, one light cruiser apparently fairly intact. German light cruisers to pursue and attack with torpedoes." Upon receiving this order, Leipzig turned at 18 knots toward a glare visible to the northwest that Captain Horn supposed might be a burning ship. By the time he reached the position, he could see nothing from his bridge, but members of his crew who were on the main deck, throwing cartridge cases overboard, observed lifeless bodies amidst a mass of floating debris. They failed to report this to Horn, who therefore did not pass the information along to Spee. The admiral therefore remained ignorant that he had sunk the British flagship. A few minutes later, Dresden stumbled upon Leipzig and, believing her to be Glasgow, prepared to fire a torpedo. Recognition came just in time. Meanwhile, Nürnberg, which had been 25 miles behind the squadron when the firing began, believed that she had missed the battle. Receiving Spee's torpedo order, Captain Karl von Schönberg turned his ship in the direction from which he had last heard gunfire. At 8:35 p.m., a lookout reported a column of smoke on the starboard bow, and Schönberg steered for it at 21 knots, but it disappeared into the darkness. This was Glasgow, which had just left Monmouth to her fate. Schönberg then observed another, larger ship about 2 miles farther away on his starboard beam. Here he found a heavily damaged British armoured cruiser, listing 10 degrees to port but still under way, her guns silent. As Nürnberg approached, the crippled vessel heeled still more, so that the guns on her port side were useless. Schönberg closed in, switched on his searchlight, and recognised Monmouth, lacking her forward 6-inch turret. The searchlight also picked out the white ensign, still flying, and repair parties moving about the shattered decks. Monmouth's propellers still threshed under her stern, and her steering appeared undamaged. Schönberg waited, his searchlight pointedly illuminating the white ensign 600 yards away. Monmouth did not fire, but there was no movement to lower the flag. At 9:20, Schönberg opened fire, deliberately aiming high. Still the white ensign was not struck. Nürnberg next fired a torpedo, which missed. Schönberg ceased fire, switched off his searchlights, and waited. Then Monmouth began to gather speed and turn toward the Nürnberg, possibly, the German believed, intending to ram or to bring her starboard guns to bear. As Monmouth turned, Nürnberg circled and passed under Monmouth's stern, now rising high out of the sea. At point-blank range, Schönberg fired. No shot could miss. The shells ripped open the unprotected part of the hull. Monmouth shuddered and heeled further until the sea rolled over the port deck rail and lapped around the funnels. Soon the ship was lying on her side, her ensigns drooping toward the water, her red keel rising. At 8:58 p.m., Monmouth capsized and went down. Schönberg made no attempt to rescue. The seas were too heavy, and his lookouts reported smoke from approaching unidentified 4 funneled ships. Eventually, as the ships came closer, they were recognized as Scharnhorst and Gneisenau. Later, Captain Schönberg wrote, "I fired until the Monmouth had completely capsized, which proceeded very slowly and majestically. The brave fellows went under with flags flying, an indescribable and unforgettable moment as the masts, with the great top flags, sank slowly into the water. Unfortunately, there could be no thought of saving the poor fellows. First, I believed that I had an enemy before me. Secondly, the sea was so high that hardly a boat could have lived in it. Moreover, all my ship's boats were secured before the action." Even so, after the battle, many of Nürnberg's officers were ill at ease about their slaughter of a helpless enemy. "It was terrible to have to fire on poor fellows who were no longer able to defend themselves," said Lieutenant Otto von Spee, the admiral's son. "But their colours were still flying, and when we ceased fire for several minutes, they did not haul them down." The battle was over. Nürnberg signalled the flagship, "Have sunk enemy cruiser," and Spee replied, "Bravo, Nürnberg." There were no survivors, from Monmouth or Good Hope. 1,600 British seamen had died. Christopher Craddock, his wish fulfilled, was one of them. By 10:15 p.m., Spee decided that Good Hope, Glasgow and Otranto had escaped. The last two were of little concern, and he believed that Good Hope was so heavily damaged that she would either sink or make for Valparaiso for repairs, in which case he hoped to persuade the Chilean government to disarm and intern her. But there remained the British battleship sighted off Punta Arenas. From signals intercepted by Scharnhorst, he knew that the battleship was coming north. Deciding not to risk an encounter with his ship, von Spee himself turned north at 10:20 p.m. On Monday morning, November 2nd, the day after the battle, the sun was shining, the wind had dropped, the sea was calm, and the ships of the East Asia Squadron, steaming at 10 knots, gently rose and fell in the following swell. In the clear air, the Germans could see the distant coastline of Chile, and, more importantly, far and wide, an empty ocean. When Spee ordered a diligent search for the shattered hulk of Good Hope, or any evidence of her sinking, the observations made by Leipzig's crew finally reached him. Admiral von Spee now knew that he had command of the sea in the southeast Pacific. To acknowledge the victory, he gave his ships the opportunity to close his flagship and cheer him, responding, "With God's help, a glorious victory. I express my thanks and congratulations to the crews." Assessing the damage to his squadron, Spee found that Scharnhorst had been hit only twice, and that both shells had failed to explode. One British 6-inch shell had hit forward on the starboard side above the armoured belt, making a hole 3 feet square and penetrating to a storeroom, but it did not explode. "The creature just lay there," wrote Spee, "as a kind of greeting." A second shell hit a funnel without doing serious damage. The 4 shells that struck Gneisenau had not seriously harmed her. The 3 German light cruisers had not been hit. Not a single German officer or seaman had been killed. 3 men from Gneisenau had been slightly wounded. For Spee, the most serious consequence of the battle was that he had expended half of his ammunition. At Coronel, Scharnhorst had fired 422 8-inch shells and had only 350 left. Gneisenau had fired 244 and had 528 left. The ammunition had been well spent. Even in the heavy sea, the gunnery of the armoured cruisers had been superb. Scharnhorst, for example, scored at least 35 direct hits on Good Hope. But the fact was that there were no more projectiles to feed to the guns, short of Wilhelmshaven or Kiel. In a private letter written the day after the action, Spee analysed his victory. "Good Hope, though bigger than Scharnhorst, was not so well armed. She mounted heavy guns, but only 2, while Monmouth succumbed to Gneisenau because she had only 6-inch guns. The English have another ship like Monmouth hereabouts, and in addition it seems a battleship of the Queen class carrying 12-inch guns. Against the latter we can hardly do anything. Had they kept their force together, we should probably have got the worst of it. You can hardly imagine the joy which reigns among us. We have at least contributed something to the glory of our arms, although it might not mean much on the whole in view of the enormous number of English ships." At dawn on Tuesday, November 3rd, Scharnhorst, Gneisenau, and Nürnberg entered the Bay of Valparaiso. As international law prohibited more than 3 warships of a belligerent nation visiting a neutral port at the same time, Leipzig and Dresden remained at sea, escorting colliers to Massafuerac. Entering the roadstead in the morning sunshine, the German sailors saw the town spread around the bay, the hills behind, and in the distance the high mountains. The harbour was filled with ships, 32 of them German merchant vessels driven to seek refuge by the war. News of the victory spread quickly, and the large German population of Valparaiso was enthusiastic. The German ambassador to Chile, Dr. Eckart, and the consul general, Dr. Gumprecht, boarded Scharnhorst, followed by officers of the German merchant ships who crowded the decks. Hundreds of men from the merchant ships offered themselves for enrolment in the squadron, even as stokers. 127 were accepted. Many of the squadron's officers went ashore, where they visited German bookstores and cafes and admired the pretty black-eyed women. Admiral von Spee did not share in the general enthusiasm. "When I went ashore to call on the local admirals, there were crowds at the landing place," he said. "Cameras clicked and people cheered. The local Germans wanted to celebrate, but I positively refused." Nevertheless, he yielded to Gumprecht's pressure and walked with 30 of his officers to the city's German club. This solid yellow building was an outpost of dark wood and German respectability, whose hallways and panelled dining rooms were hung with full-length portraits of Kaiser William I, Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, and Field Marshal Moltke, the victor of the Franco-Prussian War. Spey and his officers dutifully signed the guest book, then mounted the grand staircase to find themselves confronting a large bust of Kaiser William II, moustache bristling. Under a grand chandelier in the reception hall, the admiral was polite for over an hour, until a drunken, mindless idiot raised a glass and said, "Damnation to the British Navy!" Spey gave him a cold stare, and declared that neither he nor his officers would drink to such a toast. Instead, he said, "I drink to the memory of a gallant and honourable foe," put down his glass, picked up his cocked hat, and walked to the door. Outside, in the bright sunlight, a woman stepped forward to present him with a bouquet of flowers. "They will do nicely for my grave," he said, refusing them. That night, although the masts and decks of the German warships were brilliantly illuminated as in peacetime, Spey did not sleep. He had no illusions as to what was coming. "I am quite homeless," he confided to an old friend, a retired naval doctor who lived in Valparaiso. "I cannot reach Germany. We possess no other secure harbour. I must plough the seas of the world, doing as much mischief as I can, until my ammunition is exhausted, or a foe far superior in power succeeds in catching me." The British consul at Valparaiso learned of Spey's presence off the Chilean coast on November 2nd, but he did not know then that a battle had taken place the day before. The consul's telegram reporting the appearance of the German squadron reached London on November 3rd, whereupon Fisher, now First Sea Lord, urgently prodded his colleagues to improve the precarious position in which he supposed Craddock to be. That evening, the Admiralty finally sent the orders for which Craddock had waited so long. "Defence has been ordered to join your flag with all dispatch. Glasgow should keep in touch with the enemy. You should keep in touch with Glasgow, concentrating the rest of your squadron, including Canopus. It is important that you should effect your junction with defence at earliest possible moment." In light of the Admiralty's previous signals to Craddock and of what now had happened, this message offered grim humour. "All dispatch, earliest possible moment." Montevideo is 4,000 miles by sea from Valparaiso. At a constant speed of 15 knots, and allowing for coaling stops, it would have taken the defence 2 weeks to join Craddock. As Churchill later confessed, "We were already talking to the void." The first news of the battle arrived at the Admiralty on the morning of November 4th, in the form of sparse accounts from German sources. The following day, the Admiralty issued a preliminary public statement which was published in that evening's newspapers. "The Admiralty have no official confirmation of the news from Germany. The Admiralty cannot accept these facts as accurate at the present time, for the battleship Canopus, which had been specially sent to strengthen Admiral Craddock's squadron and would have given him a decided superiority, is not mentioned in them." The next day, the 6th, the Admiralty amplified its disclosure, saying that reports received by the Foreign Office from Valparaiso state that a belligerent warship is ashore on the Chilean coast, and it is possible that this may prove to be the Monmouth. The action appears to have been most gallantly contested, but in the absence of the Canopus, the enemy's preponderance of force was considerable. Already, the Admiralty was establishing its line of defence. Had the Canopus been present, the disaster would not have occurred. When more complete accounts arrived and were published, the British public was shocked. Some newspapers blamed Craddock. Why, with an obviously inferior force, had he given battle? Where was Canopus? Other papers and voices asked why the Admiralty had assigned and permitted Craddock to fight a powerful squadron with an inadequate force. This, overwhelmingly, was the Navy's view. "Can you imagine anyone sending such a mixed and unsuitable mob down for the job?" asked Glasgow's gunnery officer. In the Navy, the defeat at Coronel was reckoned in terms of human life and diminished naval prestige, rather than as a serious strategic blow. The sinking of two obsolete second-rate cruisers amounted to a tiny reduction of British naval strength, but 1,600 men, including the Admiral, had died. In exchange, two Germans had been wounded. And Coronel came only 6 weeks after the loss of Aboukir, Hogue, and Cressy. In the two disasters, 3,000 British sailors had died. Professionally, the question became not why was the battle lost, but why was it fought? Who blundered, the Admiral or the Admiralty? Captain William Sims, an Anglophile American naval officer who, when his country entered the war 29 months later, would become the senior U.S. naval officer in Europe, declared that "the British have allowed their old cruisers to be caught in the presence of a much more powerful enemy, and have suffered the penalty. They have committed the grave mistake of despising the enemy." Beatty had no doubt as to where responsibility lay. "Poor old Kit Craddock has gone, poor old chap," he wrote to Ethel. "He had a glorious death, but if only it had been in victory instead of defeat. His death and the loss of his ships and the gallant lives in them can be laid to the door of the incompetency of the Admiralty. They have broken over and over again the first principles of strategy." The worst that could be said of Craddock was that he was impetuous, a trait for which, along with courage, he was well known. Luce, of Glasgow, said, "He had no clear plan or doctrine in his head, but was always inclined to act on the impulse of the moment. Craddock was constitutionally incapable of refusing or even postponing action if there was the smallest chance of success." Beatty, Craddock's friend of many years, added ruefully, "I fear he saw red, and did not wait for his proper reinforcement, the Canopus." Churchill's explanation to Jellicoe was that Craddock had "let himself be caught, or has engaged recklessly with only Good Hope and Monmouth." This became the official Admiralty version, which Churchill presented to the Cabinet. It was adopted by that body at its November 4th meeting, and Asquith subsequently reported it to the King. Indeed, the condemnation went further. Craddock was declared to have been acting in disobedience of express orders to concentrate his whole squadron, including Canopus, and to run no risk of being caught by a superior force. The principal exponent of this position was Winston Churchill, who, even after the war, rejected all criticism of his role in the Coronel disaster. "I cannot accept for the Admiralty any share of the responsibility for what followed," the former First Lord declared. "The first rule of war is to concentrate superior strength for decisive action, and to avoid division of forces or engaging in detail. With Canopus, Admiral Craddock's squadron was safe. Scharnhorst and Gneisenau would never have ventured to come within range of her 4 12-inch guns. To do so would have been to subject themselves to very serious damage without any prospect of success. The old battleship, with her heavy armour and artillery, was in fact a citadel around which all our cruisers in those waters could find absolute security." In the view of the former First Lord, the whole responsibility for what happened at Coronel rested on Craddock, who, he insisted, had been expressly instructed to operate in company with Canopus. Churchill bore down hard on this point. "It ought not to be necessary to tell an experienced admiral to keep concentrated and not to be brought to action in circumstances of great disadvantage by superior forces. Still, in telegram after telegram, the importance of not being separated from Canopus, especially sent him for his protection, was emphasized." In fact, however, this command was not emphasized, indeed it was not even mentioned, in the Admiralty's October 28th signal to Craddock, which came in response to the Admiral's announcement that he had relegated Canopus to convoy duty. Later, Churchill conceded that with Canopus holding them back, it would have been impossible for Craddock's cruisers to catch the Germans. But he argued that at least the presence of the battleship would have prevented the Germans from catching and killing the British ships. From within the shelter of this floating fortress, Churchill declared, Craddock could have raised the alarm. Then, once the Admiralty had been informed of Spee's whereabouts, we could instantly concentrate upon them from many quarters. Logical in retrospect, this was neither the substance nor the tenor of the orders sent to Craddock in the weeks preceding Coronel. Craddock, of course, did not see Canopus as a citadel or a place of shelter. He saw her as an incubus. From his point of view, it was not the old battleship's guns that mattered, it was her speed. He had been told that she could make no more than 12 knots, that her engineer commander was deranged, and that, aided by a following sea and a gale wind, she made 15 knots in a frantic effort to reach the battle area, are immaterial. Craddock was never to know. What he did know was that if he followed the tactics prescribed by the Admiralty, drawing the Germans south to fight a battle involving Canopus, he might well find himself placed in the dreadful position of watching the enemy circle around him and steam unmolested around the Horn. There, naked, lay the main British coaling station in the South Atlantic, the Falkland Islands. Nor was that all, for if Spee, arriving in the South Atlantic, could announce to the world that he had come simply by steaming around the Royal Navy squadron too cowardly to fight, the shame would be unbearable. It would never be forgotten that a Royal Navy squadron had refused battle, or that the officer in command was Christopher Craddock. Craddock, in short, was not the man to seek absolute security in the shelter of a citadel. He had been told that he had a sufficient force to deal with Spee. Because Canopus could not keep up, he had informed the Admiralty that he was leaving her behind. Apparently aware of this, the Admiralty had not revoked its order to search and fight. Perhaps if Craddock had received the Admiralty's November 3rd telegram in time, he would have understood that his mission had been changed from searching and fighting to shadowing and reporting. In that case, he might have ordered the speedy Glasgow to investigate the smoke off the Chilean coast that afternoon, while he himself fell back on Canopus. And then, perhaps, sheltered beneath the guns of the old battleship, he might have been content merely to signal that Spee's squadron had been located. But this Admiralty telegram was dispatched from London 48 hours after the battle and Craddock's death. The Admiral knew that afternoon that the odds were against him, but he believed that he had no choice. The defence had been refused him, and he was as good as told that he was skulking at Port Stanley, said a Glasgow officer. What else was there for him to do except go and be sunk? He was a very brave man, and they were practically calling him a coward. If we hadn't attacked that night, we might never have seen them again, and then the Admiralty would have blamed him for not fighting. This was Craddock's meaning when he wrote to Merckx, I will take care I do not suffer the fate of poor Trowbridge. The tragedy can be blamed in part on a failure of clarity in language. Craddock never put his requirements and apprehensions clearly before a busy war staff. He was candid when he told the governor before leaving the Falklands that with such a weak force he had no hope of success, but his protests to the Admiralty were in the form of hints rather than declarations. Craddock should have understood that London had failed to comprehend his situation. But admirals of his generation had not been brought up to question orders, particularly if the questions seemed to suggest the admiral's concern for his own personal safety. Craddock had protested as much as a British admiral could. In defeat, Craddock became a hero. Confronting this new situation, Churchill, ever resourceful with language, found a way simultaneously to honour and praise the hero, deplore his judgment, and shroud Admiralty responsibility. In anticipation of a parliamentary question after the battle, Churchill prepared a statement declaring that Craddock had consciously and bravely sacrificed his squadron in a vain effort to cripple Spee. "We are of the opinion," Churchill wrote, "that feeling he could not bring the enemy immediately to action as long as he kept with Canopus, he decided to attack them with his fast ships alone, in the belief that even if he himself were destroyed, he would inflict damage on them which would lead to their certain subsequent destruction. Though the Admiralty have no responsibility for this decision, they considered it was inspired by the highest devotion." This explanation of Craddock's behaviour was clothed in further eloquence by Arthur Balfour, the former Prime Minister and Churchill's successor as First Lord.
This book is continued on Disc 11.